And welcome to our special roundtable discussion on UFOs. I'm George Norrie right here on Coast to Coast AM. U.S. Navy research physicist Bruce McAbee is the author of the UFO-FBI Connection, The Secret History of the Government's Cover-Up. Bruce McAbee received his Ph.D. in physics from the American University in Washington, D.C., 1970. He was hired by the U.S. Department of the Navy to be a physics researcher at what was then called the Naval Ordnance Laboratory. The name was later changed to the Naval Surface Warfare Center, the Dahlgren Division, where Dr. McAbee has worked ever since. Dr. McAbee says with FOIA releases and document leaks, we're learning more about what happened years ago than they knew years ago. His website, by the way, you can Google him and find out everything. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. One of our guests then tonight will be Dr. Bruce McAbee. Bruce, welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you?
Thank you.
Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
One top secret group appointed by President Harry S. Truman to investigate the UFO phenomenon was called Majestic 12, or MJ-12, in the early 1990s. 35-millimeter negatives were sent by an anonymous source to Don Berliner of the Fund for UFO Research in Maryland. On those negatives were pages of a U.S. War Department training manual entitled Restricted SOMA-1-01 Majestic 12 Group Special Operations Manual, Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology Recovery and Disposal, Top Secret/Magic Eyes Only. The man who began an investigation of that leaked document was Robert M. Wood, Ph.D. On the 35-millimeter film were 32 pages of text and drawings, and the fingers of whoever photographed the pages of the top-secret Majestic 12 classified manual. Bob Wood, now retired in California, had a 43-year-long career as an aerospace engineer, first working for Douglas Aircraft that merged with the McDonnell Corporation in 1967 to become the McDonnell Douglas, later purchased by Boeing in the early 1990s. Over those four decades, Bob Wood worked on aerodynamic heating, ballistic missile defense, radar, and the space station before his retirement in 1993. Now, that year, nuclear physicist and UFO researcher Stanton Friedman had seen the 35-millimeter negative in Berliner's possession and contacted Dr. Wood to see if he would be interested in researching what was on that film. He did, and concluded the top-secret government training manual for UFO crash retrieval operations is authentic. Also on the panel tonight, Bob Wood. Hi, Bob. Welcome to Coast as well.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Likewise, too. Also on the document trail is Grant Cameron from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, where he has worked since 1974 as a building facility manager at the University of Manitoba. Now, tonight, Grant is joining us by phone from Kansas City, Missouri, on a visit there to research at the President Truman Library. Grant Cameron has spent a lot of time in American presidential libraries and the National Archives trying to find historic memos and diaries that will connect dates of alleged UFO crashes and meetings between American presidents and military leaders, scientists, and high-ranking administration officials. He has discovered that only two sitting U.S. presidents were ever asked publicly about UFOs. The first time was on July 10, 1948, to President Truman. The second was in 1954 to President Dwight Eisenhower. Tonight we'll learn from Grant what those presidents said and a whole lot more about behind the scenes from the Kennedy to Clinton and current Bush administrations. Grant Cameron. Grant, welcome back to Coast.
Good evening, George.
Good to have you with us. The UFO phenomenon, of course, is not just disc or triangular or cylinder-shaped vehicles that can move in Earth skies at phenomenal speeds and then immediately stop and hover. Eyewitnesses have described beams coming from the aerial craft which can raise and lower objects, even heavy cows. And all over the world since at least the early 1950s, ranchers have discovered livestock of all kinds, even deer and elk, dead, with tissue and organs cut from their bodies without signs of blood or tracks. One Stanford University graduate and Denver CBS affiliate producer and reporter decided in September of 1979 to investigate the unusual animal deaths and produced a documentary called A Strange Harvest, which received a regional Emmy. In the broadcast, law enforcement linked the mutations to creatures not from this planet. Since then, Linda Moulton Howe has produced hundreds of TV programs, documentaries, radio news segments, four books, and the award-winning website, earthfiles.com. Her news beat is Science, Medicine, the Environment, and Real X-Files. And she has never given up trying to understand the truth about the global animal mutilation mystery. But military and intelligence sources have told her the perpetrators are extraterrestrial biological entities. And where to begin? The four guests suggested going back into time in 1942, 5 years before the famous Roswell controversy, to the night of February 24th, 25th, 1942, when America's 37th Coast Artillery Brigade fired 1,430 anti-aircraft shells at a UFO moving slowly over Santa Monica, California. For tonight's Coast to Coast audience, Linda has posted the very famous Battle of Los Angeles photograph that shows spotlights and artillery fire aimed at the UFO, along with newspaper headlines, a 1942 eyewitness account provided by Bruce Maccabee, and documents that have surfaced about correspondence between President Franklin Roosevelt and his Army Chief of Staff, George C. Marshall. Let's start, of course, with Dr. Wood about what happened in the early morning of February 25th, 1942, and also turn it over now to our friend Linda Moulton Howe.
And thank you, George. This photograph and these amazing documents and this eyewitness description that Bruce Maccabee has provided are right now at earthfiles.com. All you have to do is go to www.earthfiles.com, click on the headlines page at the top. It'll take you to this report, and you can look at what we're going to talk about. Going back in time to 1942 to something that really was a surprise to me, that we learned that right after this amazing battle, quote-unquote, Battle of Los Angeles, that President Franklin Roosevelt and his Army Chief of Staff were corresponding within a day after, apparently, there was a disc discovery, and it was described as being of interplanetary nature. And Bob Wood, could you start and explain for the Coast audience who might not know about this amazing 1942 battle that took place right out here over the Santa Monica Mountains, what happened and what? How did you get those leaked documents and what exactly do they say?
Well, it was a very visible event with thousands of people over the what now is the Los Angeles airport saw this object being fired at by anti-aircraft guns, and this photograph that you described shows it very clearly. In fact, if you enhance it a little bit, you can actually see the image of a craft inside the searchlights that are illuminating it as the anti-aircraft shells are going off. So these thousands of people saw it, and of course George Marshall, who was the chief of staff, had to tell the president something, and so he wrote a memo that was secret only, that was a very innocuous memo that said, hey, no bombs were dropped, we fired 1,430 rounds, no casualties, no planes shot down, and nothing lost. However, obviously, there was a secure communication, a phone or telegraph, between him and FDR, telling FDR something more was important, because that led to a memo that FDR wrote 2 days later on February 27th that said, hey, we're going to consider the disposition of the material in the possession of the Army. And what turns out that a week later, why Marshall wrote a letter that explains it a little bit, and the bottom line is that they recovered one craft in the San Bernardino Mountains, and the Navy salvaged another at sea. So that's really what happened in that week.
And Bob, it says in that document that I'm looking at, not only, quote-unquote, the Army Air Corps also recovered a similar object in the San Bernardino Mountains east of Los Angeles, And that's a quote. And another quote, mystery airplanes are in fact not earthly. And according to secret intelligence sources, they are in all probability of interplanetary origin, unquote. If this is in the Marshall FDR communication that was highly classified, then what you're saying is they already were very skilled in putting out the innocuous document the day after on channels that were not secure.
Exactly right. They did, however, classify it secret, which was basically a cover to make people think that it was, you know, the real thing.
And in my research, I've learned 6 people died, 3 from a heart attack, 3 apparently from a variety of things like a crash, something falling on them. As you pointed out, and as Bruce Maccabee in supplying that eyewitness account, Bruce, maybe you could go a little further with looking at this photograph, which at earthfiles.com, it is enhanced, and you can see what looks like the shape that the eyewitness used, lozenge, which is almost diamond shape.
Yeah, right. Actually, you can get some other views if you on a Coast to Coast AM front page there. If you click on my name, Bruce Maccabee, that'll take you to my website where you can look at further enhancements. It's a interesting situation that you have these beams from several different searchlights shooting up into the sky, and you can see where the light from the beam is, indicating that there's dust or smoke in the sky. So that reflects the beam, and that's how you can see the beam of light traveling through the atmosphere because of light bouncing off the particulate matter in the atmosphere, and it gets up to this region where the object is. All the beams converge. They all seem to stop about at the object. None of them really go past it. And if you look at the picture with varying amounts of enhancement on the picture, you can see that there seems to be something there which is almost like absorbing light or preventing the light from traveling through it, at very least. You also see little bright spots, which we presume are the explosions going off, and bombs bursting up there near the object. They would be creating smoke as well as the powder, the shell powder burns. So there would be the object up there with a lot of smoke around it. The story is this object took only 30 minutes to travel about 20 miles, 25 miles. So it was going rather slowly, giving them plenty of time to zero in on it and fire their guns.
And Bruce, isn't it remarkable that if you take the time from the newspapers, the whole incident lasted about 38 minutes. This, whatever it was that was taking all this artillery round, went unscathed in the sky, and yet there had to have been thousands of people out there watching. Why do you think that there was, so far, only one photograph surfaced?
Well, I don't know. How many people would have had cameras out there to take photographs, but with the one photograph that we have taken by a news reporter, the reporter, as I understand it, had to leave his house and travel to some location. At that time, Los Angeles was in blackout condition, so you drove along. If you did drive, you drove with your lights out.
And Bruce, wasn't that because the air raid sirens had started going off and on February 24th to the 25th, and there was an order to black out all of the lights from a part of Santa Monica all the way down past, I think, to San Diego?
Yeah, I think the order came out something like 2 hours before they actually started firing at something, implying that for some reason or other they may have had a heads up that something was coming. I don't know. It's just a guess on my part, but the city was already blacked out when they started firing, and you can read it at your website, Earth Files. You can read the testimony of Scott Littleton, a witness who was 8 years old. There are also several accounts in newspapers stories that were published at the time. Scott Littleton's account has just been available recently in the last couple of years, where he has written down what he recalls of it. But everybody recalls this thing moving along very slowly, some orangish or maybe reddish color associated with it.
And all of this artillery round that was hitting at it. And, Bruce, I wonder if it is worth asking the Coast audience, if who might be listening, and they might have been 8, 7, 8, 9 years old, whether or not they might have scrapbooks or old family albums. Maybe if we put out a request for people to look into old family albums going back to 42, could somebody out there have another photograph of this amazing event in which our government was firing at an unidentified object that was then related within the next 4 to 5 days in correspondence between the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and his Army Chief of Staff about a crash retrieval and the word interplanetary?
And Linda, do we know what happened to the object as it slowly drifted? Did it just disappear? Is that what happened?
It faded out, right, Bruce?
I guess. I mean, it's not information we have is primarily comes from newspaper stories at the time, and anybody who does research work realizes that newspaper stories tend to be truncated. They never tell everything. Whether this thing got out of range of the spotlights and faded in that way, or whether it was still in range of the spotlights and it somehow faded out, we don't know. Apparently the shell firing occurred for about half an hour.
Right. It's
and 30. Then the people who were there, remember, you know, it lasted in a certain amount of time that it stopped, and everybody assumed, well, that's all over. It would be really nice if there were somebody who was actually operating one of the guns, or somebody who was really involved directly with this, that could come up with some information that has been, you know, they may have been keeping quiet for years or whatever.
Yeah, please get in touch with us. We can go to Coast, Earthfiles at earthfiles.com. Anybody who might have
they
more
information. They can fast blast this too, Linda.
Yes.
Immediately, right now.
Yes, we really would like more information on this. And I have a very important question to ask Grant Cameron, but before I move in that direction, Bob, I wondered if anything else has come up in any other documents that have even suggested what might have happened to this object that is described in the George Marshall document to President Roosevelt, saying that the object that was retrieved in the San Bernardino Mountains was similar. It's referring to the battle over Los Angeles. It sounds like another object that they think is similar to what was being shot at and is in all of those spotlights. Any idea where it went after it was retrieved?
Well, the straightforward answer to your question is I have no documents that would shed light on that very good question. However, it is interesting, you know, you're talking about the idea of getting witnesses earlier, and yesterday I gave a talk to a group about UFOs, and I'm going to have lunch with a guy who was actually woke up and saw the firing when he was here in Santa Monica. And so these kinds of people, I think, actually are good ones to ask the question of the photographs.
Well, Linda, we're going to borrow the Battle of Los Angeles photograph, put it on the coasttocoastam.com website until your crashed surfer comes back.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
Well, you've got a couple million people trying to squeeze in. It's like a funnel.
Well, you know, this would be a good time also.
Can I make a comment?
You sure can.
If you go to the brumac.8k.com website, which is basically just clicking on my name on your Coast to Coast AM website.
You're just taking the words right out of my mouth, Bruce.
You scroll down the front page there. It says at the top, Dr. Bruce McAbee Research website. You scroll down a ways, and you'll see the battle, a bunch of sightings listed, including the Battle of Los Angeles. And if you click on that, a paragraph says Battle of Los Angeles. Here are some processed images and so on.
Should come right up.
And you click on that and you'll see my analysis, and you'll see the original photo and several processed versions of it make it somewhat clearer as to what's apparently inside that glowing, what seems to be a glowing region where all the beams converge.
And Bruce,
and also you get some calculations as to how big this thing might be. I had figured that if it was 1,000 feet away, it would be 40 feet wide. But there were some claims in the newspapers that it was at an altitude of 8,000 feet. If it were at an altitude of 8,000 feet, then it would probably have been 10,000 feet, maybe from the spotlights, and that would make it something like maybe 400 or maybe even larger, 500 or 600 feet wide.
Really huge.
Yes.
And, Bruce, I wanted to give out your website, Bob's and Grant's, and just to repeat now, the Battle of Los Angeles photograph, it's at brumac.8kasinkitten.com. And Bob Wood, all of the Majestic 12 documents are at www.majesticdocuments.com. And Grant Cameron's work on American presidents and what they know is at www.presidentialufo.com. And my website, which apparently has malfunctioned, is earthfiles.com. So keep visiting that in the next few days, because I'm going to have more reports following up this roundtable tonight. But one thing, George, is, as Bruce is saying, this could be a very large object. And if we were putting a 1,400 and some rounds of artillery,
you're bound to hit it.
Exactly.
If it's solid.
And if it was, then it must have had some kind of a field maybe around it that was deflecting. And following this whole idea that even in the FDR and Marshall correspondence, they used the term interplanetary. Well, it turns out in September of 1947, which would then be 5.5 years later, in what Bob Wood and his son Ryan have bound together in their documents, this one is called the White Hot Majestic 12 document, it says, with the passage of the National Security Act of 1947 and the historical discovery of extraterrestrial hardware and live extraterrestrial creatures has presented an unprecedented situation with regard to maintaining secrecy related to the information contained in this report in the early months of 1942 up until the present. Intrusions of unidentified aircraft have occasionally been documented, and then it goes on about the recovery of another craft in 1941, and that apparently is because there's a part of this document that refers to it and then blocks out the word Missouri. That's the famous
Cape Girardeau case.
Cape Girardeau, right. And Bob Wood, just because I'm going to go to Grant and let him talk here, I'm curious, Bob, is there anything new that has developed on Cape Girardeau beyond the fact that the Majestic 12 documents describe what seems to have been what they called a neutronic propulsion system or power plant? And the assumption from the Majestic 12 white paper is that it came from Missouri and that particular crash, retrieval in 1941.
Well, it's not clear which crash the information came from that was in the document you're talking about, the White Hot Report. But I think it was very significant that you noted very properly that in the early months of 1942 are mentioned in the same sentence as the recovery case of 1941.
Right.
Thereby giving exceptional credence to the Los Angeles air raid event being the source of a couple of more crashes. I think that's very significant.
I wonder if they ended up crashing because they might have been damaged from all that artillery fire.
Oh, I believe that's the obvious assumption that I have made. But I have no further evidence in the form of documents that says that's what happened. We're really actually, if you piece together the timeline for the Los Angeles air raid events, you have the air raid, and then you have, obviously, you have a missing piece of information, some sort of a secure phone or telegraph between Marshall and FDR that caused him to write the memo 2 days later saying how important it was. And then there was clearly a special intelligence unit created, according to Marshall, presumably the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit that we'll probably talk about a little later. And there was also a missing memo creating the Special Committee on Non-Terrestrial Science and Technology that worked during the war, trying to figure out what to do with these recovered craft.
And, Bob, if, in fact, we already had retrieved technology in a craft and maybe bodies from Cape Girardeau, Missouri, in 1941, then whatever happened in Los Angeles, there were units that were operating with intelligence about what they were dealing with. And this leads a question to Grant Cameron. Grant, you have done so much research into archives, trying to understand what American administrations have understood about an extraterrestrial biological entity presence in their technology. Could you find anything that would support links around crash retrievals? And I know that there is a name that you have found was playing behind the scenes that a lot of people might not know about, and that is James Webb. Could you take that name and kind of string for us what you know now, jumping from 1942 up to where James Webb starts to play a role?
Okay, but maybe first I can make a couple of comments on the 42 incident, because I did deal with the FDR library on this. And I think you have to keep in mind, in terms of this, that it happened only a couple months after Pearl Harbor. So the Americans were greatly on edge, especially on the West Coast. And the two documents, the only two that were released by the Roosevelt Library are the one from Marshall to the President, and then from the President to his Secretary of War, Stimson. These are found in separate files. They're not in the same file. And we know that the Navy, the Secretary of the Navy was also involved. This is a story that ran, I think, five days in a row on the front page of the LA Times. And the Navy guy was involved. And one other thing I should mention is that the memo from Marshall to the President mentions 15 objects. It doesn't mention just one. So that's something that I think has to be taken into consideration, that there may have been more than one object flying around. And the other thing, I had mentioned to Ryan, Bob's son, that there was an audio tape. Now, I don't have the details with me, but there is an audio tape around where one of the people there talks about a crash. I believe he was one of the people in the military there doing the shooting. And there is an audio tape where a crash is also described. And the final thing I'd like to mention is it is one of only three crashes. You've got the 41 Missouri crash. You've got this rumored story of a crash. And you also have a story with Cordell Hull, who was this Secretary of State. And there's a story running around that he may have shown his cousin bodies and a craft under the Capitol in 1939. So there may have been a number of different crashes that FDR handled. And I think it's important to keep in mind that FDR was very good at secrecy. In fact, there's a famous story that's been told numerous times now that his Vice President Truman wasn't even briefed on the bomb, on the fact that they had an atomic bomb. He didn't get briefed on that until about 12 days after he was took over as the president. So FDR was very good at keeping secrets, and he was working in an atmosphere unlike Truman and all the presidents after that, in which the media was not a big factor. It was UFOs, crashes. This wasn't a popular sort of topic. The media wasn't on it, so they could do a lot of this stuff in total secrecy. Mm-hmm. Whereas once 1947 came along, you had a situation where the president, this is in the front page of the newspaper all the time, there was questions being asked, and they were in a situation where they had to deal with it publicly.
And that's why they went into really an enforced policy of lying, really, under oath almost, in order to perpetuate national security and keep the peace and protect, keep people from panicking while they tried to figure out what they were dealing with.
Yeah, because if you look at the case of Roswell, they had a major leak. This thing was starting to go across the wire services, and they had to shut this thing down.
Well, what about this man, James Webb?
James Webb, I'll tell you the story. I was at the Truman Library the last couple of days, and I sort of got on Webb, and some of this may be just absolute coincidence, but it's very bizarre. I first came across James Webb dealing with the Kecksburg crash in 1965 under President Johnson. And if you were to make a list of all the people that should come to the president after a crash, the 1965 case, the day after the crash, everybody that should have been there was at the president's ranch. And one of the people that was there was James Webb, who was at that time was the head of NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And he flew into the ranch the morning after. And the reason it became important was because I talked to Stan Gordon, who was the chief researcher of the Kecksburg crash, and I asked him, I said, you know, based on who was there. And he mentioned two units, according to all the eyewitness testimony they had, and the one was the Air Force, and of course the head of the Air Force was at the ranch the next morning. The other one, he said, and he had a number of witnesses that said that NASA had been involved. And so it was very sort of timely that the director of NASA would appear at the president's ranch at 9:45 the next morning. And so that's where it started. And then when I was looking on different things, I was at the Truman Library, I suddenly came across the fact that James Webb was also in the Truman administration. He had two different positions. He was the Undersecretary of State at one point, and he was also the Director of the Budget. And strangely found out that he had been in the President's office July the 7th, the day before the famous Roswell story broke. He was in the president's office the day after, and he was also in the president's office on the 10th. So he was there. When I was last week, I was speaking at the Ozark, and I was talking to Scott Ramsey, who's working on the Aztec crash. So I got the date of the Aztec crash. So I went to the Truman Library, and I of course looked up, and that's the way I do it. I go in and I look at the president's schedule and the people around the president. Where was everybody? Is there any coincidence that the right people are in the right places? And 2 days after the Aztec crash, or the reported date of the Aztec crash, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were all in the President's office. So the Secretary of Defense was in the office, Secretary of Navy was in the office, Secretary of the Air Force was in the office, and Sidney Sewers, who is one of the people named on the MJ-12 document, he was the Executive Secretary of the National Security Council at the time, was in the office, and so was James Webb at the same time, so 2 days after.
And the date that I think that Scott is using, based on his interviews with the families of the police officers who described and said that they saw that big silver disc on Hart Canyon up there on the mesa, they said it was somewhere like around March 15th, 16th, 17th of 1948. Which date were you using?
I was using the 21st.
21st.
21st. That was the date that I had gotten.
In March of 1948.
And then to go on for more coincidences, this is something that perhaps Bruce McAbee can talk about, because he's done a lot of study on this. December the 6th, 1950, there was a UFO alert, and there was a rumored crash on the U.S.-Mexican border. And on that date, when I was researching that, I got the phone records, all the phone records inside the president's office and inside the White House. And James Webb made about almost a dozen phone calls, starting 10 minutes after the alert was called. He phoned Sidney Sewers again, who then was consultant on military and foreign affairs. He was talking to the deputy for defense. He was talking to J. Edgar Hoover.
My.
Just one phone call after another. He talked to George Marshall. It was just a one after another. And this is within about 3 or 4 hours after he made all these phone calls. And he just seems to pop up at almost every single crash. He seems to be there.
And Grant, just for clarification, does he begin with the Truman administration? He doesn't go back to FDR, does he?
No, he doesn't go back to FDR, although there is another strange coincidence there. He was a Marine pilot in the 1930s, and he was very good friends, got his pilot's license almost the same time, and was close friends with Lloyd Berkner from the 1930s, and Lloyd Berkner also appears on the MJ-12 as one of the MJ-12 people. And but he starts in the Truman administration, and he goes all the way up into the Johnson administration, which is another strange thing that we have the case of Kennedy sending out the famous National Security Action Memorandum 10 days before he's assassinated. And in that memorandum released by the Kennedy people, it talks about the fact that James Webb had been given a mission by the president to go and release outer space material with the Russians. And I think Bob Wood has a document that was leaked to them, which goes farther to say that UFO material was involved in trying. They wanted this released to the Russians.
Linda, Bob, we're not going to have time to talk because we're going to approach the top of the hour.
We can pick that up after.
And also, what I want to find out when we talk to our guests when we come back is why they think there is no disclosure. Because there's a bigger picture here. There's a reason why the government is holding back. And I don't think it's just national security anymore. There's something else going on.
There's a lot to that question. And also, to all three of you, why do you think these disks were crashing all over the place? Because we've just heard a
whole
bunch.
Seems like we've had many, many of them. And you would think that anything that had the kind of technology to get here, whether they popped through wormholes or came from motherships, that they wouldn't be that technologically weak to crash all the time. There's something strange about that as well. I also want to ask you, Linda, and I want you to think about this and pose this to our panel. If they believe, because I haven't heard this come up very often, if we're dealing with hostilities here,
yes.
If we're dealing with entities, extraterrestrials, that aren't coming here for the benefit of mankind, if you coin a phrase from the old Twilight Zone movie, to serve man, what do they really want to do with us?
And it may be that they don't have hostility, but that we approach them with aggression, and there was retaliation. And that is a big part of this question
mark.
Yeah, but
then we look at the research you've done with animal mutilations. To me, if it's being done by extraterrestrials,
why?
That is a very, very strange thing.
And it makes it very difficult for the government to talk.
And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, along with Grant Cameron, Bruce McAbee, and Bob Wood, and of course Linda Moulton Howe. And Linda, Lex tells us that your website is up and running now.
Good.
So it's ready to roll.
Good. Earthfile.com.
You got that right. So much information to talk about tonight. Look, we'll talk about the possibility of hostiles and what they may be doing. But let's pick back up, Linda, if we can, about what's going on from 47 to 50, some of these military orders to shoot down disks.
I wonder if we could start with Bob Wood. Bob, could you set the stage for what you've learned from documents leaked to you about the fact that it wasn't just one thing on the Corona Roswell, the ranch that is so controversial, but there was more happening between July 4th and July 7th of 1942 than most anyone has ever known in the public?
Yeah, the counterintelligence people of the Army put out a memo basically that was kicked off by Marshall way early in the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, and their memo was I don't have it right in front of me, but their memo was a 4-page memo that described in detail the specific locations of the crashes with coordinates and what they found, which included included people and
or dissected, wasn't it, that phrase in the IPU and the Majestic document that said that at Landing Zone 1, which was between Corona and Roswell, they found, quote, bodies dissected as one would a frog, unquote. And at Landing Zone 2 at the Trinity site, they said that there had been a report of animal parts being found.
Yes, that's right. And the interesting thing is that that is just one part of this five-page memo, which goes into amazing detail, including the possible suicide of one of the MPs. You know, a surprising thing. I think this is the memo also that alludes to the involvement of other distinguished people. Robert Oppenheimer, for example, and it talks about Wernher von Braun and Ernest Steinhoff, who were involved, of course, and aware of the recovery of the crashes. It seems pretty evident to me that when the Army and the FBI recovered the first crash in 1941 at Cape Girardeau, the Army was involved. Then the Army got another crash in San Bernardino Mountains, and then the Navy got one in 42. And then, of course, the Atomic Energy Commission got them, some of the parts, apparently, in 1947. So you have, basically, government agencies all trying to keep the other agencies from knowing what they had, which is an interesting point. It was really only much later, I think, that there was a truly coordinated effort that became known as Majestic 12.
And Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, before he died in 1998, had told me that when he was brought into the operation by General Trudeau, apparently on the request of President Eisenhower, to head up that R&D unit in the Pentagon, and in Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, it was all about General Trudeau basically handing over to Corso extraterrestrial technology, at least that's what it was defined as from crashes, to hand carry it to a variety of private corporations in the United States to have it back engineered and patented. And the idea there was that you had the Army, that was Eisenhower, Trudeau, and Corso, and he said it was made very clear to him that General Trudeau and Eisenhower considered the Central Intelligence Agency at that time to be very suspect of having a lot of spies, and they wanted to keep everything they were doing about the extraterrestrial biological entity and technology back engineering out of the hands of intelligence, which means right almost from the beginning, there were these intelligence wars within the United States wanting information and efforts to keep information bottled up separate from units that were supposed to be all working together.
That's absolutely right. And you can see this showing up in various documents. I think the classic one in my mind is the one that J. Edgar Hoover wrote in his own handwriting, say that the Army grabbed it and wouldn't let us even look at it in the L.A. case for cursory inspection. And so clearly, you know, they were frustrated by each other.
And a piece that I have been doing presentations this year about this big puzzle of what is behind the government's very strict policy of denial, apparently in the interest of national security, is a lot of emerging data that we really tried hard to bring these disks down for a period of time from the end of the 40s up till at least 1954. It was Len Stringfield who told me back in the early 80s that he had firsthand knowledge that we had been trying to bring disks down. We wanted access to the technology. And he told me, Linda, we lost so many pilots and planes that the order was finally rescinded. And he thought it was 1954. And I have in front of me a newspaper article that's one of three that I know that you all are familiar with, but I don't know that the Coast audience would know, that In 1952, a July 29th story based on a July 28th press release in Washington, D.C. This went out throughout the United States. Air Force orders jet pilots to shoot down flying saucers if they refuse to land. Now, what's so interesting, Bob, is that in the assembled documents that you and Ryan put together, the Majestic 12 documents, this is there's a section, I believe it's in the White Hot document, about the crash, the Mantell crash on January 7th of 1948, which is only a few months.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Now, what is significant is we've all heard about this pilot going up trying to chase this big silver disc and something unusual happening. Well, in here, it talks about a very strange impact on the metal. And it says it is believed by the Air Force investigators that Mantell's plane had been destroyed by an ionization phenomenon, possibly from the propulsion wash of the unidentified object's exhaust. And then it goes on to say that from 1949 to late 1950, that there have been several crashes of B-36 bombers on routine Arctic patrol that bear all the earmarks of the Mantell incident. None of the crews were found. The atomic bombs were not recovered, thus creating a serious problem for the Air Force when nuclear weapons are lost over friendly countries, unquote. You start putting this all together. Our government has pilots disappearing, airplanes disappearing or being affected with holes all over them, nuclear bombs disappearing, and they can't stop it. And we haven't even gone to the ground to talk about
this. That's right. I think your comment really paints an interesting timeline of aggressive attack by our people. And it starts actually with the 1942 Los Angeles air raid. And actually, it's summarized and synthesized in the manual that George mentioned right at the very beginning, because it talks about the craft that have been captured. So, furthermore, there's a recent book out that I happened to really attracted my attention called The Braxton County Monster, which takes an issue of September 1965, where apparently we had a real air war with three UFOs. So it continues the policy that we had to shoot them down. And I would point out that I learned that really one of the things we were doing at White Sands in the summer of 47, we was perfecting the proximity fuse, which, of course, is a microwave signal that permits you to know how close a shell is to an object. And it's very easy for me to imagine that the commanding general of White Sands at the time, who would have been, was later on the MJ-12 committee, would have said, well, hey, why don't we use our new proximity fuse and see if we can shoot one of these things down?
Right. And we know in some of this background information that I received from former New Mexico State Representative Andrew Kistner, who was talking with people at White Sands and at the Naval Research Laboratory, that they've given him private information about the fact that our government was getting, even on cameras, discs that were photographed from inside of the missiles that we were launching, the V-2 rockets, that they had photographs of these discs easily pacing our launches and apparently causing our V-2 rocket tests several times to go off course. In one famous case, it went 180 degrees, meaning the V-2 rocket was going one direction, one of the discs showed up, and then the V-2 rocket was coming 180 degrees back the other way. And these incidents would have set up a military context, which I have seen now in documents that former Representative Kistner has shown me, in which our government, aside from their balloon explanations and swamp gas explanations privately, they were referring to these as foreign enemy weapons, the discs, foreign enemy weapons.
But why? What do you think the hostilities occurred first from these extraterrestrials? or do you think we created it first? That's the big question. What did we know for us to be so hostile to them?
Grant, Bruce, Bob, you want to jump in there on that?
I'd like to make a comment. You've referred to three things so far that turn out to be on my website that people might be interested in. The December 6, 1950 immediate high alert, which is related to that supposed crash just across the border in Mexico. If you go to the, again, if you go to the brumac.8k.com website and scroll down, you'll see, you know, without going too far down, you'll see in big letters, immediate high alert. You read that, that's a report on what we know that happened on FBI, based on an FBI document of December 8, 1950, which says that the Counterintelligence Corps was put on immediate high alert for all information related to flying saucers. And you'd have to ask why. If you back up 2 days to December 6, 1950, you find that the United States did, for a period of time, go on alert as some unknown objects approached from the northeastern corner of the United States. At the time, they claimed they thought it was might have been Soviet bombers, but it's a strange thing. You have to read the report to find out why it's a mystery. Another thing was you referred to a document, a newspaper report in July of 1952 about orders to shoot down flying saucers. If anybody wants to know the context of that, you look up the year of the UFO on my website. 1952 was the year of the UFO. So during that same year, in August and again in October, the FBI was told by Air Force Intelligence that there was some percentage of UFO sightings that couldn't be explained, and that some top military officials were seriously considering the interplanetary explanation.
What do you think precipitated the announcement, Bruce, to just shoot them down, though? What had happened?
Well, in 1952, you had literally many tens of sightings coming in each day when it reached its peak in the last week sort of July 1952. That was also the time when on two weekends objects were detected on radar and seen flying around over the national capital, Washington, D.C.
Right over the White House, as a matter of fact.
Restricted areas where they were picking these things up. This is again described in a paper which is entitled Year of the UFO. If you go down my website to the Year of the UFO, then you will find out what happened during that period of time. And one can well imagine that the people who had inside knowledge were panicking that this was going to be the War of the Worlds in their face. Now, the third thing that Linda had talked about, which is on my website, is White Sands. At White Sands, we have documents showing that they detected objects flying at 150,000 feet that were 30 feet in diameter and traveling at high speed. Well, we didn't have anything at that time that could go up and fly at that altitude. Nevertheless, these are recorded on film, what known as cine theodolite devices, which are telescopes that record their images on film, and they were being used for tracking rockets to figure out exactly the trajectory of rockets. And after one of the rocket launches on the 27th of April, 1950, they actually got a triangulation, which allowed them to determine the height and size of the objects. I call this the White Sands proof. If you scroll down my the web page, you'll see White Sands proof, and I say it's been in front of our noses for years. However, it was neatly covered up by the final report of Project Twinkle.
Linda, can I make a comment on this?
Please.
I'm from Canada. We don't have any crashes. We also really don't have a military, which would sort of indicate that part of it has to do with the military actually getting some success at shooting them down.
And this is Grant Cameron speaking.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Grant.
Wilbur Smith, who ran the Canadian government program, told the story numerous times. His son has verified he saw the piece. stated that he had a piece from the 1952 overflight, that the Navy has shot a piece off a 2-foot UFO. And he maintained, and a number of people saw this, and basically confirmed that 1952 was a very important incident, the overflight of the White House, because it's one thing to have UFOs flying over Fargo, North Dakota, or Los Angeles. It's another thing to have them over the White House. This is like takeover. This is the center of power. And there's even a story. We actually have the audio tape of Frank Edwards, who was sort of like a sort of the George Norrie of the 1950s, had a huge audience, and he tells a story that indicates that it was actually told to him by Albert Einstein, that that Albert Einstein actually went to the president because there was a shoot-down order, and he'd actually gone to the president and told the president, Mr. President, if they have the technology to get this far to our world, they'll know what to do when they get here. So there was a number of people who had written letters to the president in 1952. They're at the Truman Library, people telling the president, don't shoot them down. And the last thing I'd like to sort of mention is, I think Stanton Friedman has a case where they actually, he has documented with a Cuban pilot being shot down by a UFO. They were chasing it, and it was picked up by the U.S. Intelligence people. And there was a lot of FBI involvement and a real stir over this case that Stanton Friedman had, where they actually were listening to the pilot as this whole thing occurred.
Linda, while this was going on, was this happening in other countries too, do you think?
I do, and when we come back after this break, what I'd like to do is to have the gentleman try to deal with what seems a paradox, something that can pace V-2 rockets, cause them to change, fly at 150,000 feet, be advanced technology. Why should anything we were doing bring them down in the first place? And was this happening in the Soviet Union and around the world? That would be what I'd like to pick up after this break.
And I've got to believe that this has been happening since the beginning of this planet, not just back in the 40s, for example. This was happening thousands and thousands of years before, at least. Linda Moulton Howe and our special panelists tonight. We're staying here an extra hour for you. Grant Cameron, Bruce McAbee, Bob Wood. Linda, I do want to bring in a caller, first of all, who fast-blasted me about an hour ago. We'll just use his first name. His name is Edson. Edson's late father was part of the group using the artillery during the Los Angeles situation. Let's get Edson. Edson, how are you? And thank you for that fast-blast. I appreciate it.
Okay, yeah. Actually, he was an air raid warden, and he was out there, on the block. This is Glass Hill Park, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. And the morning afterwards, he used to sell auto parts. And during the war, auto parts were very hard to come by.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, he went to the Vermont Avenue area. I guess it's Hollywood, that area. And an empty lot there, and the police had it cordoned off and wouldn't let anybody in. But they knew my father, and I think maybe he bragged him with a fan belt or a carburetor or something. And they didn't take a piece of the whatever fell there.
What do you think it was?
Well, it was, I remember, we had it in the family for a long time, and then it got lost.
No, you mean you don't have it?
No.
Well, my sister might still have it. She packed stuff away, so I'll have to contact her.
Okay, you check that, and we'll follow up with you on
that. You think it was shrapnel or something?
No, it was light. It was lightweight, like aluminum, and it was twisted, and it was about maybe 11 inches long.
Like it might have come from the object?
Yes.
What did he say in terms of what he thought it might have been?
Well, the cops told him it came from the object, so it wasn't a piece of shrapnel because the shrapnel is, like steel. And
I mean, did he think it was Edson? Did he think it was a plane?
Well, that's what they said at the time. They were very nervous because the Japanese.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're off the coast, and they thought, well, this actually was part of the aircraft, but. Maybe a strut or something like that, but
did your father see this odd object in the searchlights?
Yes. In fact, it hovered over the area. It was a bright white light.
And that couldn't possibly have been an airplane, then, could it?
No, not moving that slowly.
Did Dad think it was a plane?
No, they didn't know what to think it was. what it was, because it was moving so slowly they couldn't have been a blimp or anything like that, because it would have been blasted.
Absolutely, with all that artillery fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that you could ask your sister to look for that metal, and if she can find it, could you email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com and email George and, you know, let us know if you can find it, because it would sure be interesting to get it into some EDS and other tests.
Yeah.
Okay, Edson, we've got your number, too, so we'll call you back every week and see if you track this thing down.
Okay.
Thanks, Edson.
All right.
Appreciate it. Coast to Coast continues in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Linda Moulton Howe, and our guests, Grant Cameron, Bruce McAbee, and Bob Wood, right here on Coast to Coast. Linda, let's talk a little bit, too, about the hostilities that could have been one of the reasons why the government is still not telling us what's going on. Don't you think that's possible?
Well, if we were shooting at something that was defined as early as documents in 1942 as interplanetary, and that there were other documents saying that they were being defined as foreign enemy weapons, then our government was interpreting this in some kind of a military hostile way, maybe not knowing their agenda. And the thing that to me is very concerning in all this is that the retaliation, apparently, even if it cannot be definitely proved, comes in paragraphs like this description in the Mantell case and subsequent cases in which we lost planes and pilots. And in fact, former New Mexico State Representative Andrew Kistner did a study of newspapers back in that period of time, in 47 to in that period, and found that there were so many civilian and military air crashes. It was one period where there were 600 over a certain period of time, and it translated to 7 crashes a day for 84 days. The implication to him from his inside sources at White Sands and at the Naval Research Lab was that when we were trying to take the disks down out of the sky, retaliation was coming back in odd ways, including air crashes. Now, if you're in the government, you don't want to go in front of any press corps anywhere and make that announcement if you can't control what is happening in the skies. And then you add to that what began to occur as you move forward in time and you come to issues that maybe later in the program we can talk about, which is animal mutilations, the human abduction syndrome, and pretty soon the complexity of this.
Well, I was going to ask you, were there any reports of these kinds of mutilations going on back in the 40s and 50s?
Yes, in the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit document, in the Majestic 12 documents that Bob and Ryan Wood put together, there is this reference to having found bodies dissected as one would a frog at the site between Corona and Roswell, the reference to animal parts at Landing Zone 2 at the Trinity site in White Sands. Then Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, in his book The Day After Roswell, the man who worked for General Trudeau in Washington, hand-carrying allegedly extraterrestrial technology to American corporations on some secret mission to get them back engineered, said that he had seen with his own eyes documents, highly classified, that referenced global, worldwide, unusual animal deaths that took the same pattern of tissue, without blood, without tracks. The earliest date that he told me he saw was 1951, that would be only 4 years after July of 1947. And the document linked the perpetrators of the worldwide animal mutilations to extraterrestrial biological entities. So if our government was dealing with all of this, and in as early as 1951, they had documents describing the animal mutilations linked to the very intelligence that apparently was responsible for the discs. You can step inside the president's shoes and everyone else and say, no one is to tell, no one is to hint. We don't want public panic in the interests of national security. We are going to put a lid down on this, a policy of denial in the interests of national security. And as I understand it, that lid is still in force to this day.
I want to find out from the panelists, including you, Linda, and let's start with you, Grant Cameron, what you think these objects may be, and because it's a question that people always kick around, in whether you believe they are indeed hostile or not. Grant?
I believe they're extraterrestrial, and I don't believe they're hostile.
How about you, Bruce?
Well, I think they're clearly coming from somewhere besides here. And I don't know whether they're hostile or not. They may be just doing their own thing and trying to protect their own rear ends while they're doing it.
Interesting. Bob Wood?
I think they're coming from somewhere else, most likely extraterrestrial, but wormholes or time travel are a distinct possibility. And I think that if there's a half a dozen different sources or aliens involved, I think, just to pick a number, five of the six are probably kind of friendly, and one of them is hostile. The ones that are doing the abductions and the cattle mutilations, obviously, they're the hostile ones.
Very hostile. Linda, your thoughts?
Picking up where Bob just left off, I think that there are mixed agendas. I've always thought that seemed to emerge the more deeply you studied abductions and what happens in animal mutilations and even what people in the government have implied. And the problem is proof. And I've come to feel over the last couple of decades that even though our government has a lot of knowledge and that they have had a high priority on technology and trying to get a handle on the propulsion system of this technology, I'm not certain that our government fully understands intent either, that it's very confusing. And that may explain why today in 2005 we're hearing lots of conversations about, well, maybe they're time travelers from the future, maybe they're from a parallel universe, maybe they're from another galaxy. That kind of conversation, even from people who are behind the scenes, would suggest that maybe they're not sure exactly what we are dealing with, even after 60-some years or more of what we've been hinting about, just excerpting from these documents. And I'd like to pick up and ask the three, why do you think, if this is advanced technology from someplace else, why do you think that all of these disks were crashing maybe from the 30s up through at least maybe into the 60s, and then why did it stop?
Well, can I jump on that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Basically, I think that we adopted a policy of shooting them down for two reasons. Number one, we had an intense, excited interest in figuring out how they worked. And you can imagine the first set of Army officers standing around the one at Cape Girardeau and realizing that this is something that would help us win the war and maybe dominate the Earth, you know. And the question is, how do they work? How do they get here? So that was a major factor in from the very beginning. And then, of course, when they started to violate our airspace, flying over our nuclear facilities, and then later, of course, flying over the White House, this added the motivation to get them out of the sky. So even though people like Einstein wisely said, you know, they might be way advanced, or more advanced than we are, the military, who were controlling the firepower, said, let's get them, let's get the parts, and let's get them out of the sky. And there was nobody who could have the authority to stop that. And so, as Linda says, we lost probably dozens to hundreds of pilots in these attempts, which were then determined to be fruitless because we usually got shot down. However, once in a while, I think we surprised them, like with the proximity fuse, perhaps, at White Sands, or other technology possible interferences, like with radar. I've recently become acquainted with a former Soviet guy who was a fighter pilot who really was very well connected in other ways, and he told me that the Soviets lost lots and lots of pilots too, and at the same time we were losing them. So I think that this problem was really international problem.
I've always been fascinated too with the abduction phenomenon, not just the bedside, the ones that John Mack would investigate or John Carpenter used to, of course. How about the ones like in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where huge planes and jets were sucked up by UFOs or people were picked up and maybe never brought back to this planet? Linda, do you think that ever happened?
Well, I had read that paragraph about between 49 and the 50s up in the Arctic, how we were losing planes, bombs, pilots there.
Just gone, vanishing?
Just gone, yeah. And in fact, probably Grant or Bruce can talk about some of these cases. I'm thinking in Michigan, Minnesota, there are places down in the Gulf where the planes have disappeared or pilots have disappeared out of planes. This has always been a part of this phenomenon, not that the government has talked about it, but that it has come up through leaks. Anybody? Grant? Bruce?
Well... There is on record the Kinross incident, where a plane was flying over Lake Michigan.
Right.
And well, they saw some radar target up there, and directed a plane that already was in the air to check out the target. A guy by the name of Felix Monclaw was the pilot, and I guess he had a co-pilot. I can't remember now, but the thing is, these two targets merged on the radar scope and then disappeared, and they never found any wreckage anywhere, so we don't know what happened.
And isn't that similar to what happened to Valentich off the coast in Australia?
Frederick Valentich in October 1978 disappeared under UFO circumstances, where he was talking, he was in a small plane flying southward from Melbourne to King Island off the coast of Tasmania, and I don't know, 100-mile trip or something like that, but he had to fly over the Bass Strait, which is a strait in water south of southern shore of Australia, and he was in communication with the air traffic control center at Melbourne, Australia, and for about half an hour he contacted them to ask if they knew of any aircraft that were in the area. Over this period of time, when he was talking to the air traffic controller, it became what he was saying was essentially that it wasn't an aircraft. Whatever it was strange. And after his last communication, he apparently left the button pushed on the mic, and they heard the tape recordings of the event. The tape recording made at the air traffic control center. You hear a noise that sounds like some crunching metal something or some metallic type of noise.
Oh,
and then they set out search planes for him and never found any wreckage. I'm also aware, and Bob Wood may be aware, of the story by a guy by the name of Hawk, which occurred in, I think, 1958, when he was a weather officer at a Air Force base, American Air Force base, in Japan. And he tells a story of being in the air traffic control center at the time when some strange objects were picked up by radar traveling in the vicinity of the gap between the North and South Islands of Japan. And apparently this had happened numerous times before, because the people, he said it became clear from the way what the people were saying that they had seen this sort of a situation previously. One of the two objects came along, one of them kept going, one of them started to hover. And so they scrambled an F-106, which was a brand new type of airplane at the time. And to abbreviate the story, the F-106 guy gets up to an altitude where he says he can see the object. It's up above the clouds. The weather officer told him what he would see was a full moon up above a 10,000 foot or whatever cloud layer. And so on radar, they see the airplane and they see this object. And the airplane goes into a holding pattern, going around in circles, I guess, while they send a message to Washington, D.C. by a single sideband transmission, which was apparently a new thing back in those days. And he said they got quickly back a message saying to make a run on the object. So the guy in the airplane turned towards it, fired what would have been probably heat-seeking missiles at that time, Stinger missiles or something like that. And he said that the way the communication was arranged, he couldn't hear the air traffic controller talking to the guy, but he could hear the pilot's voice. And the pilot was saying that he launched his missiles, and the missiles traveled towards this object, and that they were exploding but not reaching the object, and all of a sudden the object turned on this big beam. I don't remember if there was a color ascribed to it, but a beam, and it was rotating the beam towards the airplane, and the pilot went into a crash dive. His voice went up into a high falsetto as he described what was going on. Controlled terror.
All right.
And plane went into a dive, but on the radar, of course, what they're seeing is the radar images of the object and the plane, and these two images merged and became stationary and then disappeared. And the weather guy said that he gave weather reports for the next 2 days, 24/7, as a search went on for the airplane, and they never found anything.
All right, stay with us. We've got a couple more hours to go here with our roundtable discussion on UFOs, and our friend Boomer from the Fantastic Forum sends me this link of a video taken during the evening of the St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican showing an object moving across the upper left portion of the screen. The video was shot at around 6 a.m. Roman time as Pope John Paul II lay in state. His funeral, of course, was held that Friday. The shot was taken from a CBS network feed camera. Shows a white object passing quickly on a trajectory from the upper middle part of the screen to the left. Some meteorologists say it was a bird. Others say it was a UFO. Strange. And you're listening to Coast AM with our guest Linda Moulton Howe, Grant Cameron, Bruce McAbee, and Bob Wood, one of our very special roundtable discussions, this one obviously on UFOs. Linda, let's chat a little bit this hour about disclosure. In your opinion, and then, you know, I'd like you to chat with your guests about this. In your opinion, why isn't the government coming clean? Why don't they just say, okay, folks, we're being visited, we've been visited. I mean, where's the national security here?
Well, we sort of touched on that in the segment just before this. And Grant, I just told George that you were working on a paper about 84 to 100 reasons why the government can't tell the truth. I'm going to throw it to you. But before I do, I just wanted to say that in all of this work that I have done trying to get to the bottom of the worldwide animal mutilations and having people in law enforcement, in government and in military background off the record telling me that we're dealing with extraterrestrial biological entities in the unusual animal deaths, that you have the whole huge human abduction syndrome in all of its complexities that is also linked to the same beam technology that people have described in the animals, that there is some kind of technology that can lift heavy animals, that can lift people, that can lift cars. And then you go to the V-2 missiles, the disappearing nuclear missiles, the disappearing pilots, the disappearing planes, the planes that have had some kind of damage to the surface that in that one document says that they were talking about some kind of ionization phenomena that had interacted with the metal. You start putting this all together and you say, how does a president with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other governments, how do they come before the world and lay all this out if they don't have control of this phenomenon? Now, my own mind, I've always thought that the human family deserves a straightforward honesty, what the government knows, the taxpayer should know as well. But I can also see, to some extent, how this got started after World War II, increment by increment, they thought, if we just keep this lid down tight enough, long enough, we'll figure this out, and eventually we'll have this technology, and we'll be able to use it and deal with whatever this is. But it's 60-some years in counting, and it doesn't seem to me that governments are in control of the phenomena. Mutilations continue. Human abductions continue. Who knows what other high strangeness on the planet in the 21st century might be related. And having said that, that it may be that it is still something that is out of our control, and until it is in our control, the governments don't want it to be public because they're afraid of panic. And Grant, with that, what about your 84 to 100 reasons why they can't tell the truth?
Yeah, well, it was the 64 reasons why the government thinks it. You and I know the answers to it, or we know what's going on, and we're not jumping off buildings. But they seem to believe, and I agree with you. You have to look at their side, and I'll just name a couple of the ones that I think are very important. The one you mentioned is how little they know, that they really can't control the phenomena. It's running around changing launch codes on nuclear missiles and all this kind of stuff. It's abductions, cattle mutilations. It's very hard to come out and talk about things that the president really doesn't have answers for. If he were to come out, and of course they're going to ask him, you know, you're the leader of the free world, and your constitutional responsibility is to protect the American people. What are you doing to protect all these people being abducted, and on. Classification is still, I think, the main one. There's a quote by Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was on record as saying that he was going to release the UFO files when he got to the White House, but he also stated that if it had to do with technology, new weapons programs, he wouldn't release that. And Bob mentioned this, that the military, I think in a lot of ways, doesn't really care where they come from or what they're doing here. They're looking at lead time in terms of weapons. If you're got a weapon that's even 5 or 10 years advanced over your enemy, you have a great advantage if war breaks out. And they're looking at technology that might be, 10,000 or a million years ahead of us, and they're just looking at this and saying, if we can control this, we have great control over our destiny in terms of war. And then you look at the thing, if bin Laden were to get a hold of this technology, if we release it and give it, and the terrorists get a hold of it, I mean, can we control this kind of stuff? One of the other reasons, when I was at the Reagan Library, I wanted to see how they reacted to other odd issues. So I filed a Freedom of Information request for the Nancy Reagan astrology files to see how this was dealt with inside the government. And when it finally came back, it was 2,500 pages of material on Nancy Reagan about her using astrology to determine what the president's schedule would be. And basically, the 2,500 pages was simply ridicule, basically 2,500 pages saying how stupid the president and his wife were. So there's the ridicule factor that the president doesn't want to be put in a position where he gets to look non-presidential. There's a lot goes into getting a president's image.
And Grant, isn't that why Hillary and Bill Clinton had to try to work in such backdoor fashion that you discovered?
Yes. Hillary had the same problem where she was, they claimed she was channeling, and I can just imagine how many pages will be in the Clinton Library when that's released. But the Clinton thing leads to another very important reason, I think, and it's the fact that the government may not be running the show. We're blaming the government. The Clinton administration, I have 1,000 pages of files right now, and I'm sure there's going to be many thousands more when they open the files next January. But we know for a fact that Secretary of Defense Cohen tried to get the answer. Webster Hubbell described in his book that the president told him to go out and get the answer to UFOs. He said he tried and couldn't get anything. Anthony Lake, who was a national security advisor to Clinton, stated quite clearly he'd never been briefed on the subject. He was totally unaware of what was going on. He was very surprised to hear stories that we had aliens captured and this sort of stuff. James Woolsey supposedly told Stephen Greer, CIA director, how can I release something that I don't have any access to? And the final thing, and this is a story that Stephen Greer tells, that Sarah McClendon, a longtime White House reporter, finally got upset, and she was the type of reporter who would ask the question nobody else would ask. She asked Bill Clinton, why aren't you doing something about this UFO thing. Why don't you do something? And she, according to Stephen Greer, leaned over and said, Sarah, there's a government inside the government, and I don't control it.
Hmm.
So basically, the government may not be in control. It may be like an MJ-12 group that basically is running the whole show.
As we have theorized in the past.
Yes, and I've had it described to me that at least now, the MJ-12 group is not confined to the United States, but that they're, I guess you might say, international controllers of that group, which is quite fascinating. And Bob Wood, I'm curious why you think, or how do you think, that the Majestic 12 group, let's say that it started with Truman and the baton kept being passed, how has it operated so successfully out of the elected and appointed government?
Well, the one of the documents that we have talking about the issue of other countries says that in the event that there is a major public landing, you know, and becomes evident that there are extraterrestrials here, we should coordinate with MI5 as well as the KGB.
So, which is England is MI5, KGB
yeah,
is Soviet.
Soviet Union. So it was very clear from these early documents that both England and the Soviet Union had independent MJ-12-like organizations. And that became particularly evident to me when one of the packages of leaked documents included about two dozen photographs of people. And the people, the slogan MJ-12 was written in big ink on many of these photographs. And so the question is, well, who are the people? Well, it turned out that I consulted some experts, and one of the guys was Sergei Korolev, who is the equivalent of the Soviets' Wernher von Braun, and who basically built their weaponry and missiles from the very beginning. So he was presumably, if this is correct, he was one of the inner circle people involved in the Soviet UFO program.
And Bob, as you read through the Majestic 12 documents, which I have been doing again for this roundtable tonight on Coast, I am struck by the fact that throughout paragraphs and paragraphs, that they're trying to deal with what they have found in these various crashes. And they're talking about a power system that seems to be related to water or heavy water, some kind of perhaps they call it a neutronic
yeah,
power.
Those words and language were proper for that era. It's interesting that the words they use are consistent with what the training was for the time it was written.
Which would relate to atomic power of some sort.
Yeah. They talk about, for instance, the word planform was a popular word in the 40s and 50s to describe the top view of an airplane. Or a flying object, but it's no longer that popular these days. But
and they talk about a lifting body, that the evidence that they're looking at is a lifting body, which I interpret today through our lens as being something that could neutralize gravity, don't you?
No, actually, I think a lifting body is just a cylinder that's at an angle of attack. It could be. I mean, that's a conventional
use. It was an aerodynamic term.
Aerodynamic term, right.
Okay.
But I would like to jump on the broader question for a second of why is there no disclosure? Instead of 64 or 84 reasons, I have just four. And they're pretty simple. I can give them to you in 40 seconds.
All right, go for it.
Four classes of reasons why we've been deceived and there's no disclosure. First is the control of the technology. This is the dominant thing, and I earlier talked about the importance that this had for our military. And the point that Linda made that you want to stay, or Grant made, that you want to stay about 10 years ahead of the other guys. The second reason is to prevent panic. And this was a panic associable, you know, with the War of the Worlds 1938 program, but also that is the actual fear of possible aliens. But more importantly, I think, is the impact of religious panic or fiscal panic. If in fact, we figured out what the source of energy was that's different from petroleum, a lot of people would be upset. The third reason is to stay out of prison. The people who were doing the running that program basically consisted of hoods who were, you know, going told to shoot people and assassinate them, and also even Eisenhower, if, for example, speculate for a moment that Eisenhower had signed a treaty with the aliens, as some people claim he did, that would have been illegal and unconstitutional because the Senate has to approve by two-thirds vote every treaty. And then finally, the most important reason maybe is to conceal our inability to protect our airspace, to prevent the cattle mutilations, to understand the technology, because even though we may understand some of it, and I think some of the reverse engineering has gone on very effectively, I don't think that we understand it all. And then we can't prevent the abductions. And finally, we can't explain where they're from or why they're here. And there's so many different sources that this is a challenge that basically no government wants to stand in front of its public that elects it and say, hey, we really don't know what's going on.
If they were friendly, don't you think they'd make themselves known in an easier way?
That's one of the reasons why they're not disclosing, is that the aliens are covering up as well.
That's what I'm beginning to think.
If the aliens wanted to make themselves known, they could land in 20 different cities at the same time.
Absolutely, all at the same time. They'd get the kind of television and radio coverage they need. They'd be splattered all over the place. There's something else going on here. I wonder if they're capturing people. I mean, coining a phrase. Remember the old Twilight Zone movie, To Serve Man?
Paper.
I mean, are they harvesting us like cattle? Are they eating human beings? Is it so horrible our government can't tell us this?
Well, there definitely is a harvest of genetic material. And it is not just from animals. It is from plants. And from people, and if you take the human abduction syndrome and you say what is one of the big common denominators, it is the removal of sperm and ova from humans. But the humans are returned and the animals are not. I mean, they're here, but they're dead.
Look, there are millions of people disappear on this planet. They don't know where they go. You know, some of them obviously murdered by sickos. But who knows if they're not just picked up, captured, and they're gone.
Well, and just take a recent case. This was down in southwestern Arkansas. It was while Grant and I and others were at the Eureka Springs Conference. We were having a wonderful time on the weekend, and little did we know that on Saturday night to Sunday, which was the 9th to the 10th of April, and we're talking on the 14th, that down in a place called Doddridge, which is very near where Louisiana and Arkansas and Texas come together, there is a farmer. He's been there for 9 years, and he runs his cattle with cow dogs. And he had two-month-old puppies and five older. So he was raising these other two. And these two were staying in a carport attached to the house. The dogs were not typically running at night, but early in the morning on Sunday, he finds one laid out with the tongue removed, with the internal organs that were removed, included the spleen, the liver. There were several organs that were taken in a cut that at the site was so clean and everything was so bloodless that he was so stunned. But here's where it's really strange. In the spine, there was a section, the vet did a necropsy. And the story that I'm talking about with all the photos are at earthfiles.com about this strange dog death in Arkansas. The spine had been cut, at least 6 inches of it, very clean, disc to disc. And the veterinarian said on the record that this is not predator. This is not anything that could be done easily. And the way it was cut and removed, I've seen in other cases linked to some of these mysterious lights.
You or the veterinarian?
I've seen in other cases.
Okay.
But this one, which is now, just in less than a week, in the United States, is a dog. And the removal of that piece of spine is really extraordinary. And the ribs. You can see a photograph in which the ribs, it looks like something just came as clean as can be, like the ribs were made out of jello.
A surgical removal.
Totally cleanly cut. And we saw that in a case in California. We've seen it in Oregon. The ribs. And now what I'm describing are why are these particular pieces taken in such an extraordinary way, but even more so, why are all of these animals left to be found when we're clearly dealing with something out there that can make nuclear missiles and airplanes disappear.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost flaunting the bodies in our faces.
Yeah,
another possibility for why the government doesn't say anything.
Yes.
Instead of saying the government doesn't say anything because they don't know what's going on or what they're doing here and so on, the opposite is the government isn't saying anything because they do know. Maybe they don't know where they're from, but they do know that they're here and what they're doing, and they know that if they said what they're doing...
That's the panic.
That would be panic.
That's exactly what I'm beginning to believe. We'll be back in a moment with our panelists and Linda Moulton Howe, and don't forget, we're going to stick around next hour where we will take your phone call. I know I debated with Linda about mentioning this, so I'm not going to mention any names, but I do want to mention this story because I did get an email today, and Linda has a copy, as the Stanton Friedman now, of an individual who claims that his father, who's in his 80s, was at Roswell, took some photographs, has pictures of the crashed UFO and the alien bodies, has them locked up, told his son when he passes on and he's 80 and he's got Alzheimer's disease, you do what you wish with these pictures. And the individual emailed me and he said, George, who do I deal with? What do I do? And so, Linda, I've given you a copy of it and faxed one to Stanton this morning and tonight, and we'll see what happens with that. He's given us his phone number and everything.
Yeah. These are the kinds of things that you hope for and hope it doesn't just go up in smoke, but if it's there, we'll report it sometime in the future.
What about the authenticity?
Two forms of hope here.
Absolutely. Bob.
One is the hope that, well, maybe you're right. The other is the hope that maybe it'll all go away.
I don't think it'll go away.
Well, that's probably a failed hope.
Yeah. What about the authenticity, Bob Wood, of some of these documents we've been talking about tonight? How do we know they're real?
Well, you have to approach it the same way you'd approach authenticating a document for a courtroom. If you have an original, you have a great advantage because then you can work on the paper. You can see whether or not the watermark is consistent for the era. You can probably match the type font with a real typewriter if it's a typewriter. And, of course, these days with printing so uniform and laser printers, you really can't do much with a type font on a printed document like that. But if, on the other hand, you work like I was lucky enough to work with the 1954 Special Operations Manual you mentioned at the beginning of the program, that turns out that was printed on a hot lead printing press, and so you can actually identify the font that was used at the time, and that in effect gives it specific authenticity. There's other ways you can do authentication too. For instance, forensic linguistics is now becoming increasingly popular. That is the idea of matching words that are commonly used by different people and then getting a probability of association of the author of the document and the document being done by that person.
And that has to do, right, Bob, with if somebody uses, let's say, the word to or a or either to a certain number of times, it becomes kind of unique to that period of time?
Well, that's one technique. Another technique, of course, is to look for words that were special. And I have two documents that kind of good examples of that. Well, one of them is the one that we talked about at the beginning. The FDR document talked about the disposition of material in the possession of the Army. He used in that document the phrase state secrets,
right,
which was very common with him. And, so basically, you can find associations that are consistent with the usage of an individual person. Einstein allegedly wrote one of the documents, too, and again, we found phrases from that are consistent with his writings.
And so, FDR is the one who kept using state secrets, right?
Yes, that's right, yeah. Also, you can look at the classification of documents if they happen to be classified, and I guess this source who just called in, the 80-year-old person,
mm-hmm,
sounds like their documents might well have been classified, and you can look at the classification stamps and can check for consistency with the stamps used in that era.
And let me ask you this. He said in the email that during that period, 47, this was stamped restricted, and he said it probably changed to classified later. Did they stamp things restricted in those days?
Restricted was a legitimate classification. It was,
okay,
however, normally used as a classification below confidential, which was kind of restricting the access to official use only. Now, there are cases where the word restricted was implying that it was restricted to only those people who had a need to know.
Need to know,
yeah.
Right.
So there's a couple of different meanings of the word, of the use of the word restricted. But now, to conclude my thought there, if the documents, I think you implied, also might include some photographs.
Yes.
Yes.
And of course, now the photographs are going to speak for themselves. And there again, you can compare what's shown on those photos with other kinds of things, depending on what it is. If it's a photo of a craft, for example, or if it's a photo of aliens, why, that becomes extremely interesting.
Bob, would you say right now that the Psalm 101 training manual about extraterrestrial biological entities and technology, is that, in your mind, the most authentic of all of the documents that you have analyzed so far?
Absolutely. It's a slam dunk for having been printed in 1954. The only little tiny possibility you could raise is, well, was it printed as a piece of counterintelligence to deceive the Soviets, let them think that we really, you know, had a good program going. But the process of imagining why we would do that to deceive the Soviets is really imponderable.
And for people listening in the Coast audience who might not have been acquainted yet with the Psalm 101 document, it goes into great detail about extraterrestrial biological entities recovered by our government. It talks about their technologies, and it has a page with drawings of, would it be six or seven different shapes?
So there's four different shapes that are shown on that page.
With different points
views.
Of view.
Yeah.
And that the one that is identified in that 1954 document as being even more advanced than the disks is the one that is triangular shaped.
Well, that's right. And the triangle shaped ones are all very, very similar to those that have been reported in the last 20 years.
Exactly. So,
They have two half page descriptions of extraterrestrial biological entities, type 1 and type 2. And I actually asked a forensic artist to draw what they said with that. And those images, I think they're available on our website site too. But, so it's really packed with information. I think the most significant part in terms of the disclosure issue is the techniques they suggest for deceiving the public to keep them away from the crash sites. You know, tell them it's a crashed airplane, tell them it's a toxic spill, tell them it's a crashed satellite. And so clearly they were desperate to use any technique they could think of to keep the public away.
And it's the Psalm 101 document that has a whole paragraph in there that says a policy of denial in the interest of national security at all costs, right, Bob?
That's right. That's right. I'm not sure the right page right now, but it implies that some of the sources for the drawings were from those that were captured as opposed to just crashed. So that implies some more aggression on our part to get them.
Linda, if you had an opportunity to see, let's say somebody brought you into an Area 51, either a crashed craft or an alien body, but you could only go into one of the two rooms, which one would you pick?
Oh, Lord, my curiosity is so big, I couldn't imagine having to choose. But I suppose if I had to choose, it would be to see the entity.
Okay.
There's something about getting the feel or the measure of something that is supposed to be organic, a sense of something perhaps even in whether it was dead or alive. Although, interestingly enough, I've talked with several people who have said that they're that their exposure to craft has included organic aspects to the craft that responded with something like nervous tissue. So you get into areas having to do with mental telepathy, controlling ships, the possibility of organic androids. And when we start getting into these areas, we're really outside of our experiential level as humans, but we're beginning to get into a technology that is somewhere merging something that mind is controlling. And then, to me, I always come to that question of, I don't understand why they crashed in the first place unless it was purposeful to be like a Trojan horse, that you could be an advanced intelligence playing chess with the surface life on this planet, and you could have a certain number of things crash for a certain period of time with the idea that you would get certain technologies into the hands of the surface life to see what they would do with it while you monitored what they were doing. I've always thought that might be part of the picture.
I would like to see the alien also. What about you, Grant?
The alien, yeah.
How about you, Bruce?
Yep.
Alien too, and you, Bob?
Well, no, actually, I would go for the parts.
You would. Why did I figure that?
A fine engineer.
Yeah, an engineer and a physicist. There's so much more to learn in physics that we don't know that that's where I start. But I think the point that Linda just made was really exceptionally important, and that is there's a psychic dimension to this whole problem that is so outside of our range of knowledge that to admit that lack of understanding it would be devastating, I think, to the image of our explorations. I think a good example of that is, you know, some of the craft, I think, have been described as having their controls of just little depressed regions for the fingers.
For the fingers, right. That was Roswell, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, that was certainly one of them. And so until we link that together with the physics that we understand, and until we figure out to the extent which time is involved, I think we really won't have the complete answer.
Do you think, Bob, that we could be dealing with time travelers, whether us from a distant future or something else traveling in time?
Well, I've been trying to avoid answering that in the affirmative for most of my life, but the more and more I get exposed to it and see that the psychic world is clearly able to do remote viewing forward and backward in time, it's clear that there's a way to transgress time. And until we understand that, I think I would have to admit the possibility that, you might be able to invent a time machine that would actually mean that some of the creatures that we're seeing are actually time travelers. However, if I had to take my choice and make my bet, I'd be inclined to say my money is on simple interplanetary transfers in real time.
Grant, I know that Wilbur Smith did that book having to do, I think that the title was The New Science, and you had mentioned him earlier, and he had that dialogue with that Mrs. Swan in the United States who said that she was in telepathic communication with beings that I believe she described as being more humanoid, not the gray Eben type.
Yeah, and that ties into the whole thing about the mind, this whole idea, which again ties into whether, you know, people control minds. It's not just the machine. It's, like the mind control, this sort of stuff, which is very important to the U.S. Military. But Wilbur Smith, actually, in the 1950 top secret memo, talks about the fact that the Americans already realized that mental phenomena was involved. And Wilbur Smith said they weren't doing very well and that they asked the Canadians if they had anything to add. They were willing to cooperate on this issue. And Wilbur Smith knew right from the word go that the mind was a very important part of the whole thing. And, in fact, this extends right to 1959, that the CIA actually had a contact, a mind contact. This Mrs. Swan, who claimed to be able to talk to the aliens, had taught a Navy intelligence officer how to do this. And this Navy intelligence officer went to the National Photographic Interpretation Center, where they analyzed all the U-2 SR-71 spy photographs, and dealt with a guy by the name of Art Lundahl, who was known as the foremost intelligence officer in the 1950s, the guy that ran the lab, and was supposedly briefed three presidents on UFOs, and they actually made a contact, which we now have the document from Jacques Vallée, which describes this whole incident where the CIA officers were in the room and Navy intelligence people that made contact with the alien, and it flew by the window of this facility in Washington, D.C.
After he made the request, correct?
Yes, and this was they had taught this Navy intelligence, and Lundahl and a Navy intelligence guy were asking the questions and asked the alien to prove that he was there, and UFO flew by the window, and Art Lundahl, this was in the 1970s, Robert Emmenegger did a documentary called UFOs Past, Present, and Future, which he highlighted this case. This is when they first disclosed that this had happened, and he talked to Art Lundahl, and Art Lundahl confirmed that he had written the memo and that the incident had occurred, but that he wouldn't go on camera on the documentary, but he did confirm the case had occurred, and this guy was a very, very powerful person inside the CIA. He's actually the guy who briefed Kennedy on the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's the guy that would brief Eisenhower every time there's a U-2. He was a photographic genius and was in charge of the photographic people who did the Robertson panel UFO work.
And it was Lundahl who was supposed to be telepathically relating to a humanoid in a silver disc that called itself AFA, or AFA, A-F-F-A, correct?
Yes, but it wasn't Lundahl. Lundahl was asking the questions. It was a Navy intelligence officer who had been taught by Mrs. Swan how to do this, and Lundahl was one of the people that was asking the questions, and they immediately called Robert Friend in from Blue Book, and he came, and they did another session with this naval intelligence officer who had learned how to do this, and at that point, the AFA, who was the alien, said that the time wasn't right, they weren't going to do a flyby that day. But Robert Friend from Blue Book said it was the most amazing case he'd ever come across.
And wasn't Mrs. Swan in the United States, who was also communicating with Wilbur Smith in Canada, wasn't she saying that she was in telepathic communication with a humanoid named AFA?
Yes, she was in contact with a couple. One was Ponar, one was AFA, and she called them the good ones. They were not blondes, but they were human types, and there's a strange case that she lived only a couple miles away from Betty Hill, and that when Betty Hill was first abducted, NICAP, who was running it, really didn't want to believe in this whole thing about little gray people who abducted people, and Admiral Knowles, who was one of the NICAP people, brought Mrs. Swan in to go and talk to Betty Hill and calm her down. And when Mrs. Swan heard that she was in contact with Grays, she would have nothing to do with Betty Hill. She refused to do this thing that she'd been asked to do and said, she's in contact with the evil ones and I'm not going to have anything to do with her. These two women is very strange. Both the incidents occurred about the same time and they lived only a couple miles from each other.
And the concept of tension, conflict, evil versus good was coming up right there with Mrs. Swan and Betty Hill.
Yeah, right from the word go, Mrs. Swan said the Grays were evil and she may turn out to be right.
Okay, well, I tell you what, we're coming up to the top of the hour. What a fast night, Linda.
It's 5 minutes ago we started.
Let's open up the phone lines. Those of you who have questions for our guests, I'll tell you what you do. You call in, you tell us your question, and then I'll have Linda direct it to one of the three panelists or to her, depending on the various expertise and the question that you have given us. So we'll do that. We'll open up these special phone lines. If you want links to the guests, Bob Wood, Bruce McApee, Grant Cameron, and Linda Moultenhau's website, they're already linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. This is a special UFO panel discussion. We call it our roundtable discussions. We have many of them. I think our next one may very well be on 9/11. But for now, it's UFOs. And Linda, do you think you would be in favor of disclosure if you found out, if you believed that these ETs were harming human beings?
It's really a difficult question. I guess in my personal own mind, I always think that honesty is the best policy, and being straightforward with the human, the whole human population, if it had happened longer ago, then it means the whole planet would have evolved through the same knowledge. Today, because there has been such an effective policy of denial in the interest of national mm-hmm. security,
or the interest of something,
opening this up is going to be a huge shock still to a lot of people.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Frank calling from St. Louis.
Ah, the old hometown.
That's right. This is it. The solid Midwest. I would like to thank you and your guests for a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
On ETs. And if I may, sir, I'd like to propose a theory as to why we're being visited and why the number of encounters have increased so dramatically since World War II. And I'd be fascinated with the with your guests' commentary.
All right.
You know, it's a sad but undeniable fact that as a consequence of human activity, we are now living in the midst of the greatest mass extinction of plant and animal life than at any other time in the planet's 4.5 billion year history. And is it just possible that the visitors are in a rush, so to speak, to collect as many organisms that are in danger of extinction or that are becoming extinct on a daily basis as quickly as possible? In other words, kind of creating sort of a Noah's Ark.
A high-tech Noah's Ark, huh?
Huh?
Exactly. High-tech Noah's Ark, yeah.
I'd just be interested to know what the guests think about
that. Linda, who do you think would address that?
Just a brief footnote, this is not the largest extinction. Clearly, the one 65 million years ago
sure.
when an asteroid hit, and the one 200 and some million.
450 yeah. million also when they say some kind of cosmic burst. What I think he meant primarily was the biggest extinction caused by us.
Yes. In terms of this question about could somebody be trying to gather a material from the Earth before it's all gone, Grant, what do you think?
I think they would have been finished by now. I think they got the technology. They would have been completed their Noah's Ark by now. I think the extinction thing is the key. I mean, the mass appeared shortly after the detonation of the atomic bomb, and we sent off a signal. They're here. They were at the sort of that pinnacle of where we can mess up everybody else's planet, and I think that's why they're here.
Bruce, what do you think?
Why they're here?
Well, meaning...
Why they're collecting specimens and parts, body parts,
yeah,
and things like that.
This man was hypothesizing that maybe it's because we are creating a whole-scale global extinction event, and maybe they've been here trying to harvest since we developed the atomic bomb.
No, I suppose it's... as good a theory as any.
Bob, do you have any comment?
I kind of like Grant's point, but I think that you know the process of a human growth population increase has been a major factor, but probably not one so scary to the visitors as our nuclear capability. You know, they've shown a consistent interest in our weaponry. And I think consistent with a nervousness about whether we're about to inadvertently set them off. I think that there's a record of a half a dozen different cases where UFOs seems to have interfered with potential nuclear explosions.
Yes, and the all those Malmstrom cases, Bob Salas talks about being down 80 feet under, and this big red thing shows up, and the security guard people are panicked, and the next thing they know that there has been an effect on the missile, either the targeting tape, or in my case, my own brother was at Malmstrom in 1975 in October when that football field sized orange fluorescent object sat down or hovered very close to one of the missile silos, and my brother knew firsthand that when they examined the targeting information on the tape, it and it alone had been changed, and they were stunned by that, and the entire missile was taken out of the silo and replaced with a new one. And what we've all wondered is, what was the targeting information changed to?
Yeah, great example.
You know, Linda, I keep thinking that when we set off our atomic bombs, unless they were monitoring us and they were close by, how would they know if they were out there in their own system?
Well, we, just in this four-hour roundtable, we started talking about 1942 and the battle over L.A., and Grant brought up 1939 as being a possible date of also somebody in our government talking about, or that somebody observed, entities in craft. I have heard that British intelligence, as far back as the mid-1920s, were reporting discs, some kind of discs, coming out of Peenemünde in Germany, up in the air silently. So how far back does the phenomenon go on the planet? And you can see my point. We didn't do an atomic test until 1940, whatever that was. The Manhattan Project was 45. Being evolved, right, and we didn't drop them until 45. So we're talking about descriptions of craft, descriptions of even possibly bodies before we were even launching the Manhattan Project.
Hmm. All right, thanks. Thanks for that phone call as well, too. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, where are you calling from?
Florida.
All right, go ahead.
I was listening to you talk about Majestic 12, and my cousin worked for Majestic 12. And I didn't know if he might be interested in getting in touch with his brother because...
Tell us more.
He told him everything.
What did he say?
Well, he didn't tell me. He just said on his deathbed, he told the family everything.
What does that mean?
Well, whatever he knew from Majestic 12, but I know we've had experiences ourselves with these beings, and we lived down south for a few years back in the 80s, and one night I just had just laid down, and, you know, I had this feeling that somebody was behind me, that feeling that you have, you know?
Well, tell me more, though, about the relative first.
Well,
I don't want to interrupt you, but you started that story.
Well, he told me when I was in the 60s up there living with them, he said that I've got something to tell you, and so he started talking about, you know, ETs, and so he said... You would not even know, I mean, if you were walking along the street, he said, you wouldn't even know that they were ETs. That's how much they look like us. And so then I just sort of went, oh, God, you know. But, I mean, it just blew me away. And I said, don't say anymore. I don't want to hear anymore, you know. And so then when my cousin died, his brother told me, he said he worked for Majestic 12, and he said he told them everything, and I can get you in touch with him.
Yes. Did he leave any documents, do you know?
I don't know if his daughter may have had some. His wife, his daughter's still alive. His wife died, but his daughter might have some. And so, or even his son, too.
Yeah, we'd like to get a hold of that, so let's put you on hold.
I can give you my cousin's number, but anyway, the thing is that, like I said, we had experiences with them ourselves. I mean, they just appeared in the middle of the night in our home. And, I mean, I must have scared them to death because all of a sudden when I tried to scream and wake my husband up, you know, all of a sudden this light just shot through the room like it was daylight, you know, and all of a sudden they were gone.
Now, were you dealing with the humanoids?
I don't know. There were two of them standing in the doorway of my bedroom, and the room was dark, but the light was behind them, and I could make out the figures, and they were like by maybe halfway up the doorway of the size, you know, their height. But anyway, the thing is, my dog, I had a pit bull right there. She didn't even move.
A lot of times, Linda, people make the mistake that they think they're ETs when they are not. They could be other kinds of entities. But we'll put you on hold. We're going to get your phone numbers that you want to give us. Tommy, take care of that on that wild card line. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I don't think Grant's used to staying up quite this late. But anyhow, I wanted to know if you guys knew anything about those... autopsies that they did on those aliens, five or six aliens that they got down there at Roswell?
Well, they only got three from Roswell,
three
we think.
There was only three from there?
Yes.
Well, I know that they ranged from 3 to 4 feet high, and that they did, on the autopsies, that they found that they had convolutions of the brain, which means advanced intelligence or old age.
What is the source of your information?
There was a guy that was on here in Portland, Oregon, that was talking about all this. I've got the sent for the documentary, so I've got it here at the house here somewhere. I was going to send it to Art Bell, and I haven't had a chance to, you know, look it up yet.
What was the fellow's name? Do you know?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember.
This Santilli?
Santilli? I can't remember. This year was back in 1974, and I think it was like June 14th or something like
That's way before Santilli.
Yep.
Well, yeah. But he did a real good job. He was talking about that Blue Book, Project Blue Book.
Sure.
And saying that, come to find out today, that that's the truth.
Well, do you have the video there? Go and get it and read the guy's name for us.
No, it's not a video. It's just, I just sent for the so it's all typed out.
Well, I thought you said it was a documentary.
Well, it's typed out. He was just, it was just his voice that was on the radio. And I didn't tape it. I just sent for and they sent me this two or three page letter looking like.
Well, do you have it now?
I don't have it right in front of me, no.
Where is it?
Oh, I think it's in my desk somewhere.
Well, go get it. I'll wait. I'll talk to Linda. You come back.
It might take me the rest of the night to find it.
And while you're looking, let me ask Bob Wood. Bob, has there ever been anything substantive in documents or even perhaps witnesses that have some kind of paper trail, even if they haven't talked publicly, about autopsies on extraterrestrial biological entities?
Well, yeah, there's... There's a couple cases where I think there's an autopsy alluded to in one of the documents that we have. In fact, one of the medical people who was assigned that's mentioned in the IPU was an autopsy surgeon. So,
and that was Dr. Ray.
Yeah, Dr. Ray. I never received any documents that specifically relate to a an autopsy video, for example.
Mm-hmm. And
I have not studied the autopsy videos to the extent that I have an opinion on their authenticity. I think that there's probably been reports of as many as three or four autopsy videos of one sort or another existing, and it would not surprise me a bit. In fact, I would be surprised if we had not done autopsies and had not videoed them as we did them. It would have been stupid to not do that. So I'm sure they exist, but whether or not the ones that we see as leaks are authentic ones or hoax ones is unclear.
Good point. First-time caller line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, I'm calling from Maui, 11:10 a.m.
Welcome to the show.
Couple of quick comments, then a quick question, then I'll get off the air and listen.
Okay.
I'm a little nervous. First of all, incredibly arrogant of us human beings to think in the world, or in the universe, this little tiny speck out there, especially with all the research that's showing so many other universe, other...
planets.
I think we lost him in Maui. He was so nervous, he hit the off button on his phone.
But I think he means, which is a really good point, we are now well over 100 and some extrasolar planets, and even though we started out finding those huge giants like Jupiter, we're getting down to finer and finer detail, and it's some scientists say it's now only a matter of maybe the next decade, and that we would be able to find planets maybe the size of Earth around other suns. And once we start doing that, believe it or not, George, we are going to be able from our planet, even if it's light years away, to even tell what kind of atmosphere, whether there's wind, from where we are, we're going to start accessing Earth-like planets with our instruments.
I guess maybe with sophisticated instruments of technology that might be a million or a billion years ahead of us, I guess you could determine then if a planet is setting off nuclear bombs. Well, I bet they'd be able to do that from great distances.
Well, actually, there have been theories not too long ago that suggest that when a nuclear explosion occurs, there's in another dimension a signal that's propagating way faster than the speed of light.
Some kind of ripple, I guess.
And that nuclear explosions may not, the perception of nuclear explosions may not be limited to the speed of light.
Could be. West of the Rockies, you're up with the panel on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, hi there, Mr. Norrie. Thank you for taking my call. I'm listening on 1120 KPNW in Lane County.
Yeah, that's Oregon.
Yeah, I've been actually listening, and I've been waiting to talk to Ms. Howe for a couple years now.
Well, you got her now.
Yeah, my dad actually had a steer die outside in the suburbs of Eugene and Crow, and it's pretty typical, I guess. I've heard of one other instance where organs were removed, and a double fist core of flesh was taken out of the anus of this 5-year-old steer,
right.
And it was found dead right next to the water trough with, I guess, a little blood on the nose. I didn't see it.
What'd your dad say about it?
There was no blood found on the skin at all.
What'd your dad think?
A dead, healthy cow. He has no idea. He just took his tractor and buried it on the hill.
Over 90% of the global animal mutilation phenomena involves the removal of rectal tissue and or vaginal tissue, and that has been probably one of the most common denominators to all of them, whether it was wild or domestic animals. Why that would be, who knows? And in a few cases, the tail is cut off right at the tailbone. And in the few cases that a veterinarian has looked at this particular cut, even if they won't report it publicly, there is a glassy surface to these cuts in the tailbone, leaving the question of what is cutting right through tailbone.
Linda, have there any reports along with these mutilations of craft or lights in the area?
Oh, constantly.
All over the
place. Yes. That was, without question, mysterious lights, craft, discs of all nature, and beams. To me, the 12 cases that I have, of which only 2 people have ever been willing to go on the record, but I have 12, where people have seen a beam come out of something unidentified in the sky, and they've either seen an animal go up in the beam,
ooh,
or they've seen an animal come down in the beam.
Slowly. Just.
And in some cases, they've seen the animals go up, and then the animals are dropped down through trees, breaking bones and leaving craters. Now, why would some animals be returned in the beam, and why would others be dropped?
Just dropped.
Yeah.
That's strange. Violently, too. The whole process. Strange. We'll be back. Linda, what's been the most fascinating UFO story you've ever heard in your career? The one
so much
that just got you.
So much came into my mind at one time. There's so many different categories, and I suppose that if you go to my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and 2, that I focused in on a series of cases in which the people describe seeing some part of themselves transferred from their body into a clone body that was either another clone version of themselves.
On a craft.
Or into a body of something that was not human. And when they have all returned from this experience, this is the interesting bottom line. They all feel that now they have a personal experience with what they would call the soul. And one woman said to me, if this was literal and real, then how does something else have access to the soul? And that has been one of those questions that has floated around this phenomena for a very long time. Is disturbing at some level, but it may be that somewhere in this issue of time travel, containers, whether it's animal, human, or plant, and something that is trying to survive, that what it needs and what it has to accomplish even involves studying us at the moment of our death. And that when you ask me what's the most fascinating, it's these cases that have taken us all the way up to what we would consider to be the inviolate transfer of our soul and spirit.
Fascinating. To the phones we go. International line, where are you calling from?
Vancouver.
Welcome to the program, sir.
Oh, great program, everybody. It's Terry here in Vancouver. A question, and then I'll explain why I asked the question. My question is, has there been much theorizing that the extraterrestrials don't actually understand our spiritual depths? And that's one of the things that they're doing. And the reason that I ask that is that there was an old Scots psychic living in Vancouver here that was respected by Edgar Mitchell and the Caseys of the Casey Institute, etc. And he had had a couple of brushes with extraterrestrials, and this was the impression that he had, was that they didn't understand our spiritual depths, and that they were studying, that was one of the things that they were studying in us.
Maybe they got so advanced they lost it. Linda, who do you want to direct this one to?
Of the three of you, I will try Bruce.
Well, this is a tough question.
That's why we're giving it to you, Bruce.
I mean, the other guys wouldn't have a chance. Is that what you're saying?
your PhD physics.
not theology. I'm not absolutely sure what the question is.
Well, in this whole question of spirituality, which is the soul, the container, and what could the non-humans be here for, it ranges a big bell-shaped curve from perhaps their whole interest is in our evolution at the spiritual level, all the way to what he was just asking, complete ignorance in the classic sense of the word, meaning not knowing anything about our spiritual relationship to matter.
Yeah, well, the problem is we don't know what the mind is, and everything spiritual we think about is constructive thoughts, which is sort of like the software that's imposed on the hardware of the brain, I guess. And it's not just spirituality, but you know, how we think and all that sort of stuff, they may have trouble understanding. There is a possibility that has to be considered because if they're here now, they could have been here 10 years ago or 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, that spirituality was actually a result of them.
True.
Either mm-hmm. because ancient people misunderstood what was going on as things were flying around in the heavens, or that the basic religious thoughts were instilled in early humans to begin with by the aliens for whatever reason.
They might have thought of them as gods.
Yes, well, that's the point that I'm making. And in the last 500 years, human beings have managed to gain more understanding and control over the universe, over our small part of the universe, just the Earth. And in so doing, don't rely so much on faith that just random events will get us through. we have more control over what's happening, and the increase in technology and so on has made us more likely to look at strange things happening in the sky and try to provide what we might call scientific explanations for it, rather than attributing it simply to powers that are beyond our comprehension.
And isn't the haunting part of this that if the Sumerian Anunnaki story were based in fact, if the alleged presidential briefing paper that I was shown at Kirtland was correct, that contained the sentence, these extraterrestrial biological entities manipulated DNA in already evolving primates to create Homo sapien, and that there is a larger box around our perceived evolution that was set in motion, seeded, and perhaps specifically guided, as you were just suggesting, Bruce, that makes the question sitting here now in the 21st century, to me, even more profound. If we were made why, and what is the relationship to one or more non-human intelligences that continue to interact with this planet?
Yeah, well, it could be that one non-human intelligence made us, and others are trying to figure out how it was done.
What about Grant or Bob?
Well, I can make a comment. I think it's pretty common in the literature that abductees talk about the fact that the aliens just don't understand the pain they're creating, and they just, they're sort of amazed with our emotions and these sort of things, which may come down to the fact the aliens may think they're doing a great job and doing what's right and don't realize how traumatic abductions are.
Especially if the ones doing the abduction are biological androids, as
exactly.
Many abductees think, and that the intelligence that has made those androids doing work on this planet could be in another timeline, another dimension, another galaxy, another solar system far away.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'd like to comment.
Sure.
Yeah, I think there's two possibilities. One is the possibility that our evolution has been interrelated with those of ETs, and the other possibility is that even though that might be true, there are still many ETs that are visiting us that independently arrived. And that was the case that I kind of initially considered before we, were exposed to those theories of long time ago. But the point is that some ETs are very likely to be skillful, say, in transportation or energy. And some of them might be skillful in psychic phenomena. Some of them might be skillful in music or painting. And I think that what's happening is that you take the case, for example, of the Walton abduction. As I recall, he saw a couple of Homo sapiens kind of people, but they were very unfeeling. And it seems like that's the way the abductors normally are. It's pretty unfeeling.
Bob, could I just make a fast footnote? Because I was just talking with Travis about this 3 or 4 days or a week ago.
Uh-huh.
He's been having flashbacks in what are dreams. He's not sure.
Just lately?
Yeah. And he's not sure if they're memories. But this is so interesting because today it's the 30th year after that 5-day abduction.
Wow.
In which his drawings showed that in the beginning they were the marshmallow-looking, very white, large, black-eyed, not grays, but something in the marshmallow level. And then the next thing, he is with the yellow-eyed, blonde-haired, a female that he said looked so much like Farrah Fawcett, and two, I believe it was a female and two males. I think it was three.
Yeah.
Okay, now what he is now feeling is that when that beam hit him so hard in the forest, when he was turning to run away because of the sound of the craft, he now thinks that possibly it killed him or would have killed him, and that they took him to revive him. And what's so interesting is, could that, if this is true, if all of this was, it would mean that the blonde beings who he perceived to be in charge, that they were trying to do something to help him, not hurt him, and that would have had a level of compassion to it. And he is raising those questions now himself.
That is fascinating.
Yes, 30 years later.
The point that I was trying to make, of course, is that each individual species, as they develop, may have their own special skills. And I think we have some special things that others don't have. I think our ability to love and our ability to appreciate the arts and our ability to feel emotion seem to be better than most of those of the aliens that we get reported about.
For that, we might be unique in the universe. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
This is Brenda from Grants Pass, Oregon.
Hi, Brenda.
My question to the panel and to you, George, and to Linda, can field it to who she wants to. You mentioned that some of the aliens had lived during the crashes, and I suppose that we have live aliens that are living to this day, right? Somewhere?
It's assumed that, but no, I don't know. Do you all think that we have some right now?
I do.
Yeah,
and
I do.
Would they be held like in Area 54?
51.
Or would they be over at Cheyenne Mountain? Would they be would they be stored in that place?
There's so many shells under which all of these peas could be hidden that it's hard to tell, even around the world.
And then the other thing that I was wondering is, if we did have these aliens that had landed and they were alive, wouldn't some of their friends in a scouting party or something go out looking for them and try to bring them back?
I think that's happened, but it also is back to the issue of, what if a lot of this is planned on the part of the intelligence in some very complicated chess game that has to do with planting bodies and technology with Homo sapien for yet some unknown possible meeting in the future?
So these guys went out on a kamikaze run, basically.
Or maybe they came here as ambassadors, you know, and they're here for a purpose, willingly.
Well, that could be, too.
I mean, if they were here
and they were to crash, if that was their agenda, you know, to make it, you know, to come down to Earth and just crash and bang up their ship so that people could come and look at it and examine it, you know what I mean, in that aspect where they would just kind of, like, try to put pieces together.
Grant?
Can I add a presidential story to this?
Yeah.
There's been, as Linda knows, and Linda was involved in one of these cases with the live alien, with being offered an interview with the keeper. This story's been leaked numerous times in the UFO community that there was a live alien. Steven Spielberg did, of course, his E.T., the extraterrestrial, and Ronald Reagan, who was very interested in UFOs, had the movie screened at the White House. And according to a fairly reliable source, at the end of the movie, or near the end of the movie, while it was going on, Ronald Reagan leaned over to Steven Spielberg and said, "I bet you there aren't six people in this whole room know how true this whole thing is." And that's basically E.T. is the story of the live alien.
Well, I do know, talking to the late president's son, Michael, who told me a couple years ago, he said, my father, George, believes in UFOs and saw one over the ranch in California, and that he wouldn't elaborate on anything else.
But, you know, we keep coming around and around to, if there are small grays, tall grays, if there are blonde humanoids, hairless humanoids, ones that I've been told that if you tried to put them next to somebody from Peru or the Yucatan, you couldn't tell them apart, and yet that was an extraterrestrial. Orientals, that you couldn't tell if you were looking at a Filipino at 30 feet away or an extraterrestrial. The idea that there is this menagerie of different types, and yet all are in agreement about keeping humans in the dark about what's going on.
What are you saying, Linda?
Well, to me, that's a big puzzle, too. If we've got all these different groups, the human mind thinks of different agendas with different physical appearances. And yet, would you, Bob, Grant, Bruce, say that it is a fair statement that no matter what they look like and no matter what the crafts are like, there does seem to be a very specific hands-off, or meaning we're not going to do anything public either, meaning the ETs. We talked about that earlier. And that's confusing, that all of these different types would seem to be interacting with the planet the same way.
Well, one comment would be
evidence of what has been called the Codex Galactica, or Ethics of the Aliens, that regardless of the different types there may be, they all realize that to go public would negatively impact or completely change our civilization and presumably thereby ruin whatever it is they're trying to do. We talked about the ethics of the potential ethics of aliens in the paper that was recently published, Inflation Theory Implications for ET Visitation. It was published in the Journal of British Interplanetary Society, which you can read on my website. You can copy it. Download a PDF version.
And it's very good.
And by the way, if you can't get into our guests' websites right now because they're getting slammed, you can do it tomorrow or the next day. Those links will be up there, and you'll be able to get right to them. Linda, the clock is getting us. We've only got about a minute or half to go, so let me very briefly thank our guests, Grant Cameron, Bruce McAbee, Bob Wood. The three of you, first of all, thank you so much for spending the extra hour with us, too. I appreciate it with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
It's been fun.
Get some sleep, gentlemen.
Yes.
Until we do the, unless you want to go six, I'm kidding. Take care, guys.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
You know, there are professionals, Linda, who have devoted a pretty good deal of their careers to finding out what's going on. They're professional men, and so
yes.
So they're doing this on their free time,
exactly.
And they're what I like about it is they're engineers, they're researchers,
physicists.
They know what they're doing.
Yes, and when you look at how far the so-called civilian, ignorant group of us who have kept pushing this stone uphill, trying to get to the bottom of what you would think would be such a natural right to know about another intelligence in the universe interacting with our planet, and to realize that anthropologists in another century or two, assuming the world survives, could be looking back at this time saying, my God, the truth was lie, and the lie was truth. How did they make it through bass ackwards, upside down century?
Linda Moulton Howe, thanks for coming by.
Thank you, George, for I'm glad to be here.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Linda Moulton Howe, Lex Lonehood, Harry Sherry. No, not Harry Carey, Harry Sherry. And Art Bell and Sean LaDesour, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.